Delius' On Craig Dhu, the Elysian Singers there, conducted by Matthew Greenall. This is BBC Radio 3. Well, you may have heard Olga Neuwirth's Viola Concerto in this evening's prom, and she was the subject of a composer portrait at the Royal College of Music earlier this evening, presented by Andrew McGregor.
Welcome to this Proms Composer Portrait, where we're about to hear young musicians from the Royal Academy of Music in London tackling what might be two of the most demanding scores they've been asked to prepare, which they've been rehearsing this afternoon with the woman who created the viola concerto that's given its UK premiere in the evening's prom, Austrian composer Olga Neuwirth. And now, Olga, the two chamber works we're hearing are from 1999 and 2005. So how do you react to working on preparing and hearing some of your earlier music on an occasion like this?
First, I feel old. And on the other hand, it's kind of strange to get in a lost country because it's long ago. And you have to re-find what you were thinking or what were your aims at this time. So the first piece I've written when I lived in Venice, and I think it was very influential for me, and I wrote a lot of pieces when I was in Venice. And the second piece is much kind of later, it's like 6 years later, and I was on another trip, and you will be able to hear that. And for me, then it's hard to find a way again on my trip, my own trip. It's like when you go back to a city where you haven't been for a long time.
You expect a lot from your players. You use a lot of what some people call extended techniques. You take particular aspects of the instrument and particular sounds that it can make, which are away from classical tradition, and you often have to kind of teach the players to learn what you want them to do with their instruments.
Well, I think in these two pieces, I'm kind of friendly. I have much pieces which I have to much more kind of explain. This was an area where I tried to become more traditional, to go back to some traditions and also quote, for example, as I thought, Messiaen in the second piece. But it's actually also always very challenging. It's very nice to explore with musician a new land. And I think composing is like being an adventurer. So I think it's also, I like to play with the unknown, and I hope that somebody follows me.
But listening to some of your music, and not just these pieces that we're going to hear, I can't help feeling that somehow I'm getting hints of some of the things you've done with electronics, and you may be trying to reach some of the same sounds and experiences and ideas that you've been able to create at IRCAM in Paris, for example, and finding ways of actually exploring with more traditional instruments similar kind of territory. Would I be right with that?
Yes, you are very right with that. Because I was very, at the beginning, immediately, I worked a lot with electronics. So for me, the treatment of the traditional instruments so they become something else was very important for me. And so not to stick only to instruments which are finished, you know, in the 19th century. And I'm a composer at the end of the 20th century now, and even already in the 21st century. So I thought electronics was always important. So, but I always love traditional instruments. So I thought, how is it possible to create different kind of sounds which could sound like electronics if I play around a little bit with them or distort them or detune them so it could create some kind of fake electronic sounds.
We're going to hear elements of all of those things in the pieces that are being played for us in this composer portrait. But so you expect quite a lot of the players and you extend them into areas that are perhaps not familiar to them. What about us? What about the audience? What do you expect from us? What do you expect us to bring?
Well, I don't want to force anybody, but if somebody is open, this is the most important thing. So if you don't have petrified brains, then it's open for everything.
Well, let's explore the first piece we're going to hear. It's Ad Auras in Memoriam H. Now, tell us something about the dedication.
Well, as the title says, In Memoriam is an In Memoriam piece. So it was written for a friend, important friend who died very early, especially when I lived in Venice and I couldn't say goodbye. So this piece is a goodbye, an addio, so after the death. And this is the H, that's why the first letter for the name. And I refer a lot to the sound, the note of the B. And I was playing around with the B. So the B is detuned, so the B becomes a whole world. And the other thing is because I lived in Venice and I like to go on the Laguna, and so there's this incredible silence sometimes, and there is no breeze, and you only hear air and very, very soft changes of colors of the calm sea. So you can, we will be able to hear that. And then there are little kind of like somebody tries to get life again. And there are some, there are patterns which come back and overlap each other. So they try to find one line, but they will never have one line because they are also out of tune. So trying to be together at the same, you're always separated.
So that explains the tuning. You've got the first violin tuned down about a third of a tone. And so you get that never quite perfect unisons, even when they're playing very close together. And a lot of very ghostly spectral sounds, the harmonics, the glissandi, the flautando bowings, all of those kinds of techniques. But we also have on stage a wooden drum, and this isn't any kind of off-the-shelf instrument. It's a cube. It's specifically 43 centimetres by 43 centimetres. Why? Is this from a particular tradition? Is there some historical reference here?
No, I was trying, because these airy sounds of the and the ethereal sounds of the two strings, I wanted to have this cut, something is cut off, like life is cut off all of a sudden. And this wood has this, actually it has no real resonance, and it has doesn't have a real beautiful sound, like a traditional drum with skin. So if you hit it, it has always this crackling sound. So it's like, also the rhythm is very not very complicated. It's like a conduct if you are on a march, and what is Trauermarsch?
A funeral march.
It's a funeral march. So this is kind of the reference to yes, a funeral march.
Well, let's hear it. To perform Ad Aris in Memoriam H by Olga Neuwirth, please welcome violinists Min Majo and Cassandra Hamilton and percussionist James Crook, and two page turners for the string players as well. Ad Auras to the Light, In Memoriam H, written by Olga Neuwirth in 1999, performed by musicians from the Royal Academy of Music, violinists Min Majo and Cassandra Hamilton, and the wooden drum played by James Crook. Now, Olga, In Memoriam, music and memory, and, well, the sounds and ideas in classical music and tradition that surround us, you seem to like to find the cracks in some of those ideas and explore our attitudes to tradition in uncomfortable ways.
Uncomfortable or uncomfortable?
Uncomfortable.
First, I really would like to thank the musicians because it's really amazing how these young people, it seems like it's very easy to play this music. So this is really important, I want to say that. Well, I'm kind of haunted and obsessed by memory and what the brain does to us. Since I'm a child, we have a lot of problems with brains in our family and what brains can produce. Maybe even that's why I'm a composer, is also, I think, a brain damage somehow, I have to say. Who wants to become a composer nowadays in the 21st century? But the interesting thing is, what does recollection to us? It's fake recollection. We think it's recollection. It's distorted recollections and shortened recollections, and they pop up and they are triggered by something you don't even know. So this is what I always like to do in my music. All of a sudden something comes from somewhere you don't know, expect it, like the wind brings something to it, or even the brain kind of pops something up you wouldn't expect. So sometimes like, oh my God, what is she doing? Where does that come from now? And then it's gone again. So you're like, ooh, where is it?
So are you using these ideas consciously as triggers to see what they make happen in a listener's mind, or is it more controlled than that? You don't want that sort of random effect. It's you articulating something of your own.
Yes, I'm constructing it, but it's like experiences I have with my own brain, let's say, because I went to, you know, like for example, Oliver Sacks, and I really did brain my own brain waves to see what happens while I'm composing. It's very interesting when you do whatever you do, what part of the brains, also, for example, are densified or are stronger activated. This is what I really always like to do in my compositions, is like play with this and play with different kind of materials, very heterogeneous, but they all kind of come together to a synthesis, which is, of course, isn't a synthesis, but it's like the brain is a labyrinth, so everything kind of my music is a labyrinth. And sometimes there's a lot of things going on at the same time and you don't know where to listen to. So my obsession is, what does the brain do us, and especially also to a composer, because in music, the timeline only goes in one direction. There is no going past, back. Like in films, you have this wonderful thing that you make a recollection through just taking a material and pretend that it had happened, but with us it's not possible. So when we are repeating something, it's a fake recollection.
But you quote other composers or use other composers' music in your pieces. I was thinking of a piece called No More, where you take fragments and samples of composers going back back in history and have a sort of compressed history of music going on alongside a live ensemble. So surely you're doing something of the same kind yourself there, aren't you?
Yes, because that's my brain. There's too much at the same time.
So we're actually seeing the process in front of us.
Yes, kind of. It's a picture, which is not a picture. It's a sound picture.
But then with the trumpet concerto, which you wrote as well, there are allusions to various things in trumpet history, aren't there? You get sort of from Mahler to Miles Davis all in the course of this one piece. Again, not quite directly quoted a lot of the time, but you feel the flavour and the intensity of those areas of music.
Yes, it's more like illusions. I really like to give illusions. But especially with the trumpet concerto, it's my own history. I was a trumpet player and I lost my trumpet because of an accident that I will never be able to play the trumpet anymore. So I gave this poor trumpet player everything I wanted to do ever. So, and the different kind of repertoire I was playing. So everything is kind of there and not there anymore because it's fragmented.
Well, we're going to hear the next piece in a few minutes. We're going to hear Marcius II, but I suppose you ought to tell us a little bit about the first Marcius piece, which was a solo piano piece, before we hear this.
Well, I wasn't satisfied with a solo piano. I'm not so into solo instruments with nothing around. I think it's kind of naked, and I'm more interested in creating bigger sounds. so that you don't know anymore which instrument is which and you can't distinct anymore who is who. And that's why I also sometimes like to do this detuning. So Marcius too is kind of an orchestration of the piano part. And Marcius was this poor Greek half-god who was a wonderful artist, but dared to challenge God, Apollon, to compete with him playing instruments. And of course, this is not allowed. So he went too far, and because of this hybris, of this arrogance, which the god means with an arrogance, he was playing better than the god. He was punished, and he was killed, and his skin was torn from him, and the blood went into a river. And so I was very intrigued by this whole picture of what is an artist, how do you challenge power as an artist? Do you kind of go too far, or not far enough? Or at in the end, everything becomes like a river. And as I'm so intrigued by water, I thought this is a wonderful picture that an artist, if he dies, becomes a water.
Now, to what extent is the competition between Marcius and Apollo depicted? Because you do have your wind player.
Yes.
Marcius, he played the aulos, which is a reed instrument, but you have the flute. Is this a warning to flautists?
Well, good. The aulos was a double reed instrument, and so I think he's something in between. Maybe he will survive. But the thing is actually, so what triggered my imagination was that the god is just playing not very sensitive and not very creative, but he had like the biggest skills, let's say. So this music is kind of very mechanical. We can recognize very mechanical music, and it gets harsher and harsher. And the other way, as a contrast, you have trying to gestures of passion, of the mixture as from having technique, but also the knowledge of convey something about human beings. I mean, Weisheit, I don't know what the English word is. So you have sensitivity and skills. Mm. So this is what you can be able to hear. It's always between these kind of two worlds, kind of fight between two worlds.
Now, when you were talking earlier, you mentioned Olivier Messiaen, as though there was a quotation. Now, we can hear that there are some sounds near the beginning of the piece which are quite like Messiaen. Is it actually, is there a quotation here from Messiaen?
No, as I always do, it's a fake quotation.
And why?
It's an illusion because I wanted to trigger this kind of sometimes, this beautiful, erratic, floating sound world of Messiaen. You don't know where it's going to, but it's really very beautiful, and the timbre is very rich. So I wanted to have this kind of like opening curtain to what is going to happen then.
Well, let's get our players on stage, and if we've got a moment, I'd just like to get the flautist Thomas to show us one or two of the things that Olga asks him to do in the score. So let's get them on stage. Flautist Thomas Hancock, viola player Richard Waters, cellist Pei Ji Ng, and pianist Daniel Leipart. Now, Richard and Paige are playing Scudatura. They've retuned their strings very much in the way that one of the violinists did in the first piece. And this time, one's gone up, one's gone down, so there's actually a bigger gap, about two-thirds of a tone. Now, Thomas, there are, eight special instructions from Olga. Let's have alternating harmonics. This is a trill between flageolet tones with a ground note. And you're asked to do a tongue ram, sounds a major seventh lower. And finally, let's have, it looks like a sort of tone cluster on the page, a band of natural harmonics, dirty sound, she's put in brackets, aggressive attacks. It works for me. Let's hear the piece, Marcius II by Olga Neuwirth.
That was Marsyas 2 by Olga Neuwirth, played by musicians from the Royal Academy of Music in London, flautist Thomas Hancox, viola player Richard Waters, cellist Peiji Ng, and pianist Daniel Leipart. And it ends tonight's Proms Composer Portrait of Olga Neuwirth. It was presented by Andrew McGregor earlier today at the Royal College of Music. This is BBC Radio 3. Well, now it's time for some highlights from the Proms Plus Late, recorded on Saturday evening after the main prom concert. It's introduced by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Thank you. Well, good evening and welcome to Late Night Jazz and Poetry in the Elgar Room, right up in the rafters of the Royal Albert Hall. Tonight we have music from the relatively newly formed Chris Maddock Quintet. They're going to be performing in a bit. But first of all, we'll be hearing from the poet Sam Rivier. He's a founding editor of Stop Sharpening Your Knives. And his new anthology, 81 Austerities, came out just at the beginning of August. Please put your hands together for Sam Rivier.
This poem's called Year of the Rabbit. There is no purer form of advertising than writing a poem. That's what the monk told me. If I were a conceptual artist, I would make high-budget trailers of John Updike novels, but no actual movie. The scene where Angstrom drives towards the end of his life, down a street in the suburbs, lined with a type of tree he's never bothered to identify, and laden with white blossoms reflecting slickly in the windscreen. I would fade in the music as the old song was fading out, keeping the backing vocals at the same distance, kind of balancing the silence. The word rabbit appears in 10-foot trebuchet. This is called Dream Poem. I know what you're thinking. It's dull and aesthetic sex dreams, dreams about violent murders. Mine are pretty banal. I dreamed I wrote a poem beginning hi and ending see you later. The middle part was amazing. That's the part I don't remember. I was sitting on a platform high above the jungle. This all feels really familiar, probably from something I've seen on TV. I was dressed up as a witch doctor and used this stick of judgment, taking back the names of creatures, restoring them to myth. I was doing wisely with it. In my dream, the poem didn't have this assonance that's creeping in. After I'd taken back everything, I kept hold of my stick, using it to designate the categories that really matter, while adding bones and wings to my hat, sitting up here out of danger. I hate this, I like that. This is a poem about spending the entire day indoors. Heavily. Today is a day of zero connectivity. I brush my teeth and dunk my face in water, which is what you wash your breasts with. I want to use the exact same soap and drink orange juice, probably from Spain. Now there is a jellied light in the kitchen and outside the same air we all have to breathe. The day is in some kind of tank. All I will do is think of increasingly horrible things to tell you, striking the side of my head for a new image. There is no competing with the spectacular and obvious. Am I not a child at the opera of emotions? I was listening to the rap artist Ghostface Killah on the train, and I misheard one of his lyrics. I thought he said, "My face saw her magazine," which I thought was this amazingly complicated statement about surfaces and appearance and desire and stuff like that. Actually, he said, "My face on her magazine," meaning the woman he was thinking of approaching in the rap song was reading a magazine with his own face on the cover of it, which is probably a good thing for him. Anyway, I preferred the line I misheard, so I chose that as a starting point to write a poem. My face saw her magazine. Across the moonscapes of skate parks, you are 13 years old and no longer allowed to play with boys. On platform 6, wearing your amazing cape, you are not in fact you, but someone else. Well, I'm someone who misses lyrics, resulting in a more beautiful but private understanding. With your dark fringe, white shirt and straw hat, you are the palest goth at the picnic. Resolutely uncharmed by my very charming friend, you are the poster of disinterest. In bed and matching underwear, you are disguising the tunnel we dug in the American prison. Not answering my texts, what you are is the briefcase glowing with golden contents. I realize I can only look into one eye at a time. It is pure propaganda, the pupil a blot of blackest inkjet ink. In your luxury woolen garments, you are an advertisement for luxury woolen garments. And then you wink. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Amsterdam by the Chris Maddox Quintet, ending tonight's selection of highlights from Proms Plus Late, recorded on Saturday in the Elgar Room of the Royal Albert Hall in London. The poet Sam Riviere read from his own work, and the programme was produced, I beg your pardon, introduced by Sarah Moore Peach. BBC Radio 3, it's just gone a quarter to 11, and time now for the essay, which this week is devoted to Percy Grainger, the Australian-born composer and pianist. This week we've three eminent musicians talking about different aspects of Grainger, and the focus tonight is folk song, which was one of Grainger's major enthusiasms and preoccupations. Here's the writer and director of the Cheltenham Music Festival, Myrig Bowen.
Imagine this. You are a frail old man in your 80s or 90s, once a farm labourer, sailor or cart driver, and now seeing out your days quietly in rural Gloucestershire. A swanky car draws up to where you're living and some well-dressed, well-to-do, cheerful people pile out. You don't know it because they appear to be from another world, but these visitors include an ex-prime minister, a well-known novelist, a famous painter, a dashing young concert pianist and a couple of society hostesses, one of whom is the long-term mistress of the ex-prime minister. The pianist, quite a lot younger than the rest, bounds up to you and asks you if you know any songs. You do. Your head has been full of songs for the whole of your life, and you start singing them, not just to the assembled party, but to a high-tech recording device that you've never seen or even dreamt of before. This scenario may seem a little far-fetched if you try to imagine it taking place in contemporary Britain. Would an ex-PM, a novelist, a painter, a pianist and some posh girlfriends ever be hanging out together, I wonder, let alone visiting doddery folk singers in Gloucestershire? But it's exactly what happened just over a century ago, in April 1908. We're at Winchcombe Workhouse, a few miles north of Cheltenham, in the company of Arthur Balfour, Prime Minister between 1902 and 5, Lady Elcho of Stanway House, the painter John Singer Sargent and the writer H.G. Wells. The pianist is Percy Grainger, star musical turn of Edwardian London's aristocratic soirees and, with his debonair fresh-faced enthusiasm, the charismatic Australian eye candy of many a weekend country house gathering. I describe Grainger as a pianist here because this was how most people would have known him then, a stylish recitalist and foremost interpreter of the piano concerto by Grieg, whom he'd met and befriended in London in 1906. But Grainger's talents as a composer and arranger were increasingly coming to the fore during the decade or so that he and his mother based themselves in London before their departure to the United States at the start of World War I. And by the time of that Gloucestershire visit in April 1908, Grainger was a seasoned collector of folk songs, effectively in the dual role as self-appointed musical anthropologist and opportunist composer seeking authentically rustic, timeless melodic source material. If it was Lady Elcho's hospitality at Stanway House that facilitated Grainger's so-called folk fishing cruises around Gloucestershire, it was the similar hospitality of the Carrie Elwes family at their country seat in Brigg, Lincolnshire, that started Grainger off with folk song collection a couple of years before that. During the course of four separate trips to Brigg in 1905 and 6, Grainger collected over 300 tunes from 60 or more singers, the majority of them men. One of these was the winner of the inaugural Folk Song Prize at Briggs' North Lincolnshire Musical Competition on the 11th of April 1905. Joseph Taylor was a 72-year-old bailiff on the Elwes estate at Brigg, and alongside his winning entry, Creeping Jane, Taylor sang a number of other songs to Granger, including Brigg Fair. That day, Granger transcribed it the way that people like Lucy Broadwood, Cecil Sharp and Vaughan Williams were doing at the time, with pencil and paper. On his fourth trip to Lincolnshire in the summer of 1906, he had with him an Edison Bell phonograph and recorded Taylor's singing for posterity on wax cylinder. He subsequently used his clout as a popular recording artist to get the Gramophone Company, later HMV, to make commercial recordings of Taylor singing nine songs in 1908. The same recording pioneers, the Gisberg brothers, had caught the uniquely curdled sound of the last castrato, Alessandro Moreschi, in Rome a few years before. Capturing Joseph Taylor on 78 RPM was not quite as remarkable an act of recorded historical preservation as that, but it is a special privilege for us to hear, in this century, the traditional singing of someone who was born in the 1830s. And its influence on the contemporary folk world, since a release on vinyl in the 1970s, has been far-reaching.
It was on the 5th of August, the weather hot and fair, unto Brigg Fair I did repair, for love I was inclined. I got up with the lark in the morning, with me heart full of glee, expecting there to meet my dear long time I'd wish to see.
In May 1906, Granger brought back to Brigg Joseph Taylor's Brigg Fair in a sumptuously chromatic, unaccompanied choral arrangement. His sophisticated, ingenious and touching arrangements of this and other songs he'd transcribed in Brigg the previous year must have caused quite a stir. The next year, Granger gave a copy of his arrangement of the tune to Frederick Delius, who subsequently threaded it, Passacaglia-like, through his 15-minute orchestral rhapsody, Brigg Fair. Joseph Taylor was invited to London for the premiere in March 1908, and Granger observed that the old man became red with pride when he recognised his song on a big orchestra. It may or may not be apocryphal, but Taylor is supposed to have stood up and sung along too. Taylor's presence at that London concert is, I think, telling, because it marks a fascinating blurring of cultural and class boundaries, a meeting of town and country when the two were hugely distinct. A traditional singer from a then relatively cut-off part of England sits in a London concert hall, amidst musically educated figures such as Granger and Delius, and hears his tune transformed into a piece of complex, notated art music. A certain kind of politically minded musicologist might brand this as cultural appropriation, a kind of stealing from the people. And certainly, if we imagine Granger with his retinue of distinguished high society hangers-on at the Winchcombe Workhouse, the idea of dredging the inmates for their folk tunes, as one of them called it, is potentially distasteful. Was there something inherently condescending and exploitative about all this folk song collection in the early years of last century? The cultured, educated elite breezing into the countryside and saving the lower classes' musical heritage for the nation. The appropriation and incorporation of folk music into art music went further back than Delius's Brigg Fair, Kodály's Dantes of Galanta, or Vaughan Williams's Dives and Lazarus variants. Haydn and Beethoven arranged many hundreds of folk songs for publication, not just from German lands, but from the British Isles too. Big-hitting romantic composers, Brahms, Liszt, Dvořák, Tchaikovsky and Grieg, were not oblivious either to the charm and romping energy of local rustic tunes. What was different about all this early 20th century song collection was a dual sense of thoroughness and urgency. They wanted to get to the source, to roll up their sleeves and document this orally transmitted musical culture with meticulous application. And there was a very real fear, at a time of increasing industrialisation, mechanisation and migration off the land, that if they didn't capture these tunes, they would be lost forever. Szymanowski described the alternative community he became involved with in the southern Polish mountains in the 1920s as the emergency rescue squad of Tatra culture. Earlier, in 1907, Bartok and Kodály claimed that traditional Hungarian music was endangered by the influx of light music in the villages and mass-produced imitation folk song. "It is high time for us to get down to work," they wrote, "to do our patriotic duty neglected so far." Vaughan Williams's motivations for folk song collection, too, were wider and more idealistic than mere selfish compositional gain. Together with Cecil Sharp, his was a straightforwardly evangelical and local aim to give English folk song a massive rebirth through widespread printed dissemination in schools, to make these tunes, as VW put it, common property again. "Is not folk song the bond of union where all our musical tastes can meet?" Vaughan Williams wrote in 1932. "One day, perhaps, we shall find an ideal music which will be neither popular nor classical, highbrow or lowbrow, but an art in which all can take part." Granger's own ideal was equally democratic and impressively cosmopolitan. He collected and arranged folk songs not just from around the British Isles, but from Scandinavia, New Zealand and the South Sea Islands. As long ago as 1915, 7 whole decades before Peter Gabriel and friends established WOMAD, the great visionary Granger wrote what was effectively a blueprint for folk and world music festivals. The article, headed "Let All the World Hear All the World's Music," envisioned an international recording and touring circuit. One programme might consist of Norwegian fiddling, pipe playing, cattle calls, peasant dances and ballad singing, he wrote. Another of various types of African drumming, marimba and zanzi playing, choral songs and war dances. And yet another evening filled out with the teeming varieties of modes of singing and playing upon plucked instruments indigenous to British India. This was inspiring, far-sighted stuff indeed, but with a prescient warning too of globalisation's homogenising effect. Granger noted, "The distressing spectacle of the gentle but complex native arts wilting before the irresistible simplicity of our ruthless Western civilisation." I wonder what the 93-year-old Daddy Shepherd or the 83-year-old Archer Daddy Lane made of Granger's visit to the Winchcombe Workhouse in 1908. Was there any sense of social outrage, of being patronised, of feeling like yokel exhibits at a zoo? About their encounter specifically with new technology, Granger wrote in a Folk Song Society article that year that many of the singers he encountered were familiar with gramophones and phonographs in public houses and elsewhere, and all were agog to have their own singing recorded. Perhaps these two ancient Winchcombe residents didn't get to the pub too often. Granger's letters describe enthusiastic toil on his folk fishing trips, up with the lark, cycling 50 miles or more each day for his musical field work, enjoyable encounters with people he described as big-hearted and amusing, but naturally dirty-handed and filthy, staying up until the small hours transcribing the songs he had taken down. If that is slightly at odds with the spectacle of him turning up at the Winchcombe Workhouse in an ex-Prime Minister's grandiose motorcar, I think it's important to focus on his apparent respect for these rustic types. "The greatest crime against folk song is to middle-class it, to sing it with a white-collar production and other townified suggestions," he wrote in 1952. Crucially, Granger's notebooks feature affectionate character studies alongside the musical annotations. As his article for Musical Quarterly in 1915 noted, H.G. Wells, who was with me during a folk song hunt in Gloucestershire, on noticing that I noted down not merely the music and dialect details of the songs, but also many characteristic scraps of banter that passed between the old agriculturalists, once said to me, "You are trying to do a more difficult thing than record folk songs. You are trying to record life." I wonder whether Ronald Blythe was aware of this earlier piece of social anthropology when he set out to document rural life in Suffolk for his remarkable book Aikenfield 60 years later. Granger may not have been the most assiduous of folk song collectors. His was more a fling than a long-term relationship compared with the more deeply committed Cecil Sharp. his use of the phonograph and resulting transcription techniques were controversial at the time and remain so with a band of musicologists who bat their intriguing arguments to and fro. But without those 50 or so days spent in Lincolnshire, Gloucestershire and on a Devon quayside a century ago, we wouldn't have the Taylor recordings. We wouldn't have the dozens of solo and choral arrangements. Lyrical, touching, quirky and brave, inspiration to Benjamin Britten from the 1940s onwards in his own folk song explorations. And we certainly wouldn't have Granger's 1937 masterclass in colour, counterpoint and harmony for military band, a Lincolnshire posy. If there's any doubt that Percy Granger made friends in the fields, homesteads and workhouses of Edwardian England, the dedication in the score says it all about his warm regard and respect for the folk singers he encountered 30 years before. Knowing by then that they were all dead and gone, and living himself in a very different world in upstate New York,